Hello and welcome to the SRNA Ask the Expert podcast series, Community Spotlight Edition. I'm Landy Thomas with the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association. For this episode, I am pleased to be joined by Cindy Ronnie. Cindy Ronnie is a 79-year-old retired educator who lives with her wife, Shelley, and service dog, Hollis, in Santa Cruz, California. In 2005, her life changed drastically when she was stricken with transverse myelitis. Within 4 days, she went from golfing and playing tennis and working vigorously as a superintendent of a local high school district to being a paraplegic. You can find her full bio in the podcast description. SRNA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at wearesrna.org. This episode is made possible in part by the generous support of Amgen, Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease, Genentech, and UCB. Hi, Cindy. Would you be willing to introduce yourself to us, like your name, your diagnosis, what you love to do in life?
Hi, my name is Cynthia Rainey. I'm 79 years old. I live here in Santa Cruz, California, and my diagnosis is transverse myelitis. I'm a T3 complete, age of A, and my onset was acute, and it was in 2005. In July, and hasn't changed much since then in terms of my physical situation. Unchanged.
Not too much of a change. For like your early diagnostic journey, that's a big question that a lot of people like to hear about other people's like process. Mm-hmm. For you. When did it first happen to you, and what was that process of, like, you know, getting to the hospital, trying to get the diagnosis? Were you able to get a diagnosis in a relatively decent amount of time, or no?
Yeah. No, not at all. It was very puzzling. It took a while. My first inkling that something was wrong is I had a foot that went a little limp. We had been traveling in Scotland, my wife and I, and been at our daughter's wedding. And towards the end of the trip, I was a little bit tired. Came home, met some grandkids here at the house. We're playing around. I remember giving some of them piggyback rides. I felt in good health. I'd been golfing the day before down in San Diego. When we were in Scotland, we had played 4 or 5 rounds of golf, walking up and down Scottish hillsides, carrying bags. So very vigorous and good health. Tired from work. I had a big job, and it was really good to be on vacation because I was sort of worn out.
You but were when we gone at a school, right?
Were you still superintendent? I was still superintendent, yes. Uh-huh. And it was a big stressful job. I've always wondered if that has something to do with my onset and inflammation, but we'll never know that. Yeah. So after I had this bit of a weak foot, I went to work, and during the day I got a really, really bad backache, but I've had backaches before where I've had to go to the chiropractor. And I even lay down on the floor in my office because my back hurt so much. So I thought, this isn't good. I went to my general practitioner, my primary care physician. She examined me. She didn't know what was wrong. She said, I'm concerned. I don't know what it is. Don't go to a chiropractor. Go home. Pick up some prescriptions on the way there. She sent me a prescription for steroids and some anti-pain medication. And she said, if you lose control of your bowel or bladder, get to the ER right away. So I was in the drugstore, and I had to wait in line to pick up the prescription. And the oddest thing, as I was standing in line, I said to myself, I'm having a hard time standing up. That's the weirdest feeling. So I actually went to the aisle where there were canes, and I borrowed a cane to help me stand up. And then I went home and took the medication, lay down, was still in pretty good back pain situation. And then I lost control of my bladder. I got up to go to the bathroom, and oops, there it is. Didn't make it to the bathroom. So actually, I called an advice nurse, and I said, my doctor had said, head to ER if this happens. She said, yes, get to the ER right away. So I went to the ER, gave the basic information for the triage, and it was a little bit crowded. So I sat down, assuming I'd wait quite a bit of time, as it usually happens in the ER. And then all of a sudden, they say, Cynthia Rainey, I went, uh-oh, why are they calling me so fast? So I went in and there was a team of doctors and nurses and specialists and lab technicians, and they were doing lots of tests and talking among themselves and then calling more people in. They were really concerned that something was wrong, because by now, pretty much my whole left leg was on the verge of numb, and the back pain was pretty severe. But one by one, the specialist said, no, it's not my problem. No, heart's fine. Nope, lungs are fine. Orthopedically, you're fine. You know, no broken legs or anything. So I lay in the emergency room for probably 7-8 hours with different people saying, no, my specialty's checked off. Neurologist came in. It's probably something neurological, but I don't know what it is. And lost part of the picture there.
Oh, you're good.
I'm okay. So
yeah, I can see you.
Okay, thanks. They said, well, we'll get you a bed. We need to do some more tests. So I'll shorten the story a little bit. So I ended up in a room. They still didn't know what was wrong. They did more tests. They did an MRI. They did a spinal tap. Other tests I don't remember the names of. And after a couple of days, they said, I think what's happened is you've had an infarction in your spine. Okay, but you should be okay. We'll get you over to rehab. And a month or so, you should be back to normal. Okay. So I lay in bed that night, and the physical therapist had given me some range of motion exercises. So I was doing the range of motion exercises in the middle of the night. And I realized I can't move my legs. And the paralysis had gone from my feet up my legs up to my tummy, and it was rising. So that was pretty drastic realization in the middle of the night. So I rang the bell and said, I need to see the doctor's paralysis. It feels like this numbness has turned into not being able to move my legs at all. So the neurologist came in. He had the oddest look on his face. This was a couple hours later he came in.
The same neurologist as before?
Yes. He's, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with you. This is not a spinal infarction, but we're going to get you over to Stanford. So they transferred me to Stanford Hospital. I'd been in a hospital in San Jose. And then it was sort of the same thing at Stanford. Lots of specialists, lots of residents, lots of med students looking at me with puzzled faces. Oh, here's an interesting case. We don't know what's wrong with this lady. So it took about 7 days to actually get the words transverse myelitis spoken. And ironically, a friend of ours had a colleague who had transverse myelitis, and he was one of the first ones who spoke those words. Maybe you have transverse myelitis. And it was about that same day that a doctor came in and gave me that diagnosis. And then I was waiting for, okay, how do we treat this? What are we going to do to treat this? And they basically said, well, there's really no treating this. Actually, they didn't say that. I said, how are we going to treat this? They said, well, we're going to send you over to Valley Medical Center Rehab Center. It's one of the best in the country. And, okay, that's great. And I still had in my mind, like, okay, I'm going to get rehabbed and in a sense get over this. And then when I went to do some reading about transverse myelitis, at the time at least, the articles that I read said, well, you have about a third of a chance of getting better, third of a chance of staying the same, and third of a chance maybe it'll get worse. So I thought, well, that's not a cure. So when I ended up at a rehab center, and one of the nursing assistants actually came in, and she was tidying things up for me, getting me settled in. And in a very sweet voice, she said, so how long have you been a paraplegic? I thought, wow, I didn't realize I was a paraplegic. And
yeah.
I said, well, I just got admitted. So it was pretty stunning to go from, we don't know what's wrong with you, to you have transverse myelitis, to here's how to use a wheelchair for the rest of your life. So it took about a week. It's a long answer to a short question, but it took about a week to get a diagnosis. And very fortunately for my in my situation, The paralysis stopped there right at chest level. My biggest concern was that it would keep going and that I would lose the use of my hands, but I have full use of my hands, which is a blessing every day to me. I have quad friends and their life's a lot harder than mine. So I'm very grateful that the paralysis finally stopped when it did. And from there, I did rehab for about 6 weeks. Back then, they gave us more time in rehab than other folks I know got pushed out a lot sooner. And got quite comfortable with the wheelchair and had good PT, good OT, and sent me home to start a new chapter in my life.
Yeah, it's so sudden and so like life-changing. I'm sure that, I mean, like when I went paralyzed when I was a kid, when I had the instance of paralysis, I was able to get a lot better with time, which I'm really grateful for. But we had so many thoughts of like, you know, we lived in a two-story house and that wasn't going to work. You know, yeah. like we were very much trying to figure out, do we need to sell the house? Do we need to get like a, you know, ranch style doll on story? Because my bedroom's upstairs and they were having to like help me like get up the stairs. I can't even like move. It's so sudden. It's so like, you know, everything around you. Yeah. And yep. Nobody talks about the like the hidden cost of like trying to make your house accessible. We try to like show a lot of different accessibility tools through our, you know, through our website, through our all our stuff, but gosh, it's expensive to get all the things you need. Chairs
alone. That's a good point. Yeah, we often say how fortunate we are that I had a good job. We have a one-story home. We had the means to remodel a bathroom.
Yeah.
And to put in a lift that took me up to the garage to help pay for a ramp van to put ramping around the house so I could get around the yard. And
it's
you know, so often we think, what if we weren't able to do that?
What if
I didn't have a support system? I could be in a nursing home with the same ill-fitted wheelchair they gave me when I left the hospital. It's because there's a lot of equipment, a lot of supplies that go into keeping you healthy, as you know. So I feel very fortunate that I was employed and I went back to work after 6 months and had a good salary and was very fortunate to be able to take care of things financially. Plus I had good insurance. So folks who don't have all that, those means and support system, they need a lot of help from the rest of us.
Right, a lot of disparity, which is hard. I'm just grateful that you had all that. I mean, like it's really important to have like a support system and having like a wife and kids and grandkids and everything that you
need. Essential.
Yes.
Essential to the good mental health, no doubt about it.
Love is curative in its own way. So
it is. Awesome to hear that. Yes. Love and laughter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I've done a little research on you because I was really excited about this and getting to like see your story. And I know that you are Paralympian, and I know you're shooting for the 2028 LA Olympics, I believe. How's that been going for you, that process?
The training's been going good. I mean, technically, I'm not a Paralympian. I'm trying to be a Paralympian.
I'm trying to be.
Just so that I don't want to misrepresent my accomplishments, but I have participated in 3 Pan American Games, so
which is awesome.
I compete quite a bit at the international level. My training's going well. Like I try to help able-bodied people understand that when you're an athlete and you're a para athlete, there are always these ups and downs of health issues that arise, and you have to stop your training. And recently, I had some surgery early in March, so I'm just now finally getting back to what I would call training, finally able to play at least an hour a day at table tennis. And the training is a lot of fun. It involves working with a coach, doing some physical exercises outside the ping pong training itself, playing in local tournaments. And the next international tournament I'll compete in happens to be in Spokane, Washington in August. So my target right now is to get back to where I was and then get better and participate with athletes from all over the world in August. And then you have to do quite a bit of international travel to make a Paralympic team in table tennis, because it's all based on accruing points. And the only way you can get the points is by traveling to other countries and participating and getting medals in a series of events. It's not like, here are the Olympic trials, Paralympic trials, and if you do well this one day, then you'll get to go. Yeah. Or you've been doing well. Some committee will sit down and decide who to send. Another thing I didn't realize when I first went for the Olympics, and I've been trying to get there for at least 12 years now, several cycles, is it's not that they take the best. It's not that the Paralympic Committee takes, let's say, the best top three female players in the United States and send you to the Paralympics. You have to be, in our sport at least, one of the top 16 in the world. So for the last three cycles of the Paralympics, no females have gone from the United States in table tennis. And we've only had three players go at all. So you have to be, like I said, basically top 16 in the world just to go. You can't, like, I'm top ranked right now in the United States, but I'm down around 23 internationally. So right now I wouldn't qualify. So my skills have to get better. My competitiveness has to get to another gear, so I win more matches and get more medals and that qualify that way. So it's pretty arduous. And go back to means, it's very expensive. Tournaments in Finland and France and Argentina. I don't know how people have a chance at competing internationally without some support. And I do have the support of some wonderful philanthropists who are helping support my quest. So without that, I really couldn't do it. It takes just too much money.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. I mean, gosh, and travel alone, I mean, traveling with a wheelchair is very difficult.
It's arduous. Yeah. And the older I get, the more difficult it gets. I don't transfer the way I used to. I used to transfer in and out of cars pretty easily. And I really don't like to do that anymore. Yeah. Most people, as they get older, get into that osteoporosis realm. And I've had broken legs, and I don't transfer in and out of taxis anymore. So I'm dependent on finding transportation that has ramps. And one nice thing about these tournaments, they're para tournaments. So there's a very bus with a lift. Yes, they're very accessible. Mm-hmm. There are people at the hotel to meet you, and the venues are right next to the hotel. So it's a treat to go to one of these tournaments, because everyone around you has some, in the case of Paralympics, a physical disability. And it's almost at the fun level to see how everybody else is managing their issues, and it's almost thrilling to be in that community and not be, in a sense, a minority, but to be the majority. Oh, everybody here, at least in my category, my classification, is in a chair. Everybody's overcoming obstacles, and everybody has a story. It's quite an enriching experience.
The room where nobody like looks at you funny, you know? Everyone,
nobody.
They're all nobody's going to ask you a silly question. They're all like supportive. It's really cool to be in a room with people that are, you know, on that.
You understand that. Absolutely.
Ooh, yeah. I've had those moments in my life with like going to like patient days with different, you know, different organizations, and that alone, you know, saved me many moments, you know, going around a room and being able to just like be myself and not have to like hide it and not have to like be, you know, ashamed of it or anything like that. There's a lot of like, you know, disability pride and trying to like, you know, make sure that you feel confident in yourself even when you're facing a disability. And so I've had to kind of like come to terms with that and kind of accept what I can and can't do at any given point. And I think a lot of us have to like come to terms with that with time. But having that community aspect kind of, you know, seals the deal.
Right.
Yeah. Another fun
aspect of those games, the tournaments, is I'm considerably older than all the other contestants. I often play teenagers, kids in their 20s, 30s. I'm 79. So often I'm old enough to be my opponent's grandma. And that's fun. And I'm often seen as sort of the matriarch of the crowd. And I enjoy that role.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're getting to inspire like countless younger generations and like, you know, countless people. It's really cool. And I think that, like, I mean, first off, you're navigating a disability and of course you're navigating, you know, getting into older age, and it's like, it's fantastic. And
thank you.
I think a lot of people, and myself included, you know, I hear a lot of stories because I work with a lot of different people, and a lot of people talk to me about, you know, when they get diagnosed, they have to kind of change their dreams a lot. Like, I know that, you know, speaking of my own experience, when I was, you know, younger, I was part of ballet and, you know, like hip hop dance. I wanted to be a dancer. That was like my number one thing. And then everything happened, and I was like, you know, and I was facing so much pain and, you know, out of chair, in hospital, out of hospital. And I kind of I felt like I had to give up in certain aspects. And I think a lot of people feel like that, like they, you know, are physically exerting, you know, a choice of life can be hard. But you, I think that you represent a lot of this like overcomer spirit. What, like, how did you get to that point? How did, like, I think the story, your story is really like powerful because you did get through the stress of like, am I going to be able to do that? What was that thing?
Well, I've always turned to athletics for fun, for feeling good. I've played tennis since I was 8 years old, and we always played table tennis at my house. I was one of six kids, and our mother died when I was very young. I was only 10, and my dad was left with six kids, and we all sort of turned to athletics, I think, to keep our spirits up and to keep things going. And my dad would always say, you know, go outside and play, go shoot some baskets, or go play baseball, or get on your bikes, go for a ride, go down to the tennis court. So that was just what all of us kids did in our Hall family. And it's always been a part of my life. I played tennis and tennis tournaments since I was about 10 years old. I competed in tennis. And as an adult, I competed in table tennis tournaments, tennis tournaments. And so when I found I was going to be in a chair, then fortunately, I had some wonderful people around me who said, oh, I know somebody who's active in wheelchair sports. And the rehab center I was in also gave us some examples of wheelchair sports. And one gal named Sharon Kelleher had been in the Paralympics in wheelchair tennis, and she came to visit me. And she just was matter of fact, well, without even saying, do you want to play tennis, or here's how you play tennis in a chair, or do you think you could do this? It was just her can-do attitude was, we practice on Thursdays. You know, when do you get out of the hospital? Here's the park where we play, and come on out. And we start at 6 p.m. and we play for a couple hours, and I'll meet you there. It was just, I think, her positive assumption from her sitting in a chair and her having been to Paralympics and in wheelchair tennis that really set me off on the right foot, so to speak. That it was, he just assumed, oh, you were a tennis player, you can play wheelchair tennis. You have your arms, you have your hands, no problem, let's go play. So that was a big, big help that I had Sharon to get me started. And then I was also trying to see, you know, what else can I do? First, I love to play the piano, and I've always taken piano lessons and was improving my piano skills. So I had somebody bring me some music, and there was a piano at the rehab center. And I sat down, I went to play the piano, and I realized, I can't really do this. I don't have the balance to sit up and play the piano with two hands. So that was an example of, I really can't do this. You know, I think if it had been my heart song, if my life turned on piano, I probably could have figured out adaptations to get back to playing. But it just wasn't quite there. So I still play piano, but I just play one-handed because I collapse forward if I try to play with two hands. So that's an example of something I would have loved to have continued, but it didn't really work for me. But in terms of the tennis, once I got out on the tennis court, I realized oh, this is a flat surface. This doesn't have cracks. This doesn't have angles. I can really move. I can feel that sense of movement. And oh, it just felt so good. And then like I can still hit the ball and I can still hear that thwack and I can still feel the fun of getting the ball over the net and hitting it past somebody and picked it up pretty fast. And then being who I am and used to being in tournaments all my life, then I got onto the national circuit of playing wheelchair tennis and did that for about 5, 6 years. You got nationally ranked to the top 10, but I was 58 at that point. And in that sport, I realized I don't really have the strength, stamina, nor wheelchair skills to compete at a high level in this sport. So I went to a sport today. You know, often rehab hospitals will have those. And I went to one where they gave us lots of examples of sports that one can participate in. So from there, I had a chance to play a little table tennis with some nationally ranked people. And just after a few minutes, they said, oh, you could be pretty good at this. And that's all it took. A couple of people in a chair saying, you know, you could do this. You could excel at this. So I think you never really know what those little moments of encouragement can do. And in my case, both for the wheelchair tennis and the wheelchair table tennis, it was the confident voices of a couple of folks who had been in chairs longer than I that really made a difference.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, you had so many awesome people in your corner, especially Sharon. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, Sharon. I now play table tennis with her. She's since moved to Santa Cruz, and now I helped introduce her to table tennis. And she comes up to the house. We play together, and sometimes we go to the same center and play. And I'm trying to convince her to get more serious about it so we could train as a doubles team. But so far, she hasn't quite caught the bug totally.
Sounds like she's like a friend for life, which is awesome.
Perfectly so.
I love that she assumes competence. I think assuming competence that you can do, like someone can do something, is important. You know, I think we can always be our own worst enemies and our biggest doubters. Mm-hmm. Having somebody that's like in your corner that's like, hey, you can try something. It might be, you know, might not work for you. And that's fine too. But like, at least try is really, that's a solid push. And I think, you know, it's important to be like, you know, reasonable with things. And if you find that like something like piano doesn't work, then it doesn't work. And that's fine too. It's a lot about accepting what the limitations are, but also trying to push and see where that limitation actually is. And that's something that I've tried to get better at with time. And something I think that a lot of people could really benefit from is trying to figure out where to push and where not to push. And, you know, having like a person like you, someone that's in their corner. So I think that's like, honestly, your story is really like magical to me.
Oh, thank you. I love your words. Assume competence. Yeah, that was so refreshing to have somebody do that for me as opposed to seeing me, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. Yeah, that's very important to share that with each other. And it has taken a lot of honesty in terms of what I can't do. For instance, I'm a very driven person, and I was very eager to get back to work. And I remember my doctor saying, well, what's the rush to get back to work? I said, well, it's just, excuse me, let the dog out here. I'm just motivated by that. Working is a large part of my life. I want to get back to work, which I did.
Yeah.
After 6 months, but I realized I went back part-time and then increased my time to full-time. But I realized for me to work at this high-level job, it takes everything I have. You know, all the time it takes for personal care, for transportation, for accommodations at work. I realized I can do this, but it's basically all I would do. And I had to admit to myself, I think it's better that I retire. And so I worked for one more year till I got to age 60 and then retired at age 60. But that was a tough decision, but the right one. Like, yes, I could do this, but again, it would take,
go back.
It would take too much.
You did prove it to yourself that you could go back for a little bit. And you know, I think that's important too. It's so much.
I could have continued it had I had to have done it. I could have done it. But in my case, I was at retirement age already. I don't have to do, I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm trying to have the best lifestyle I can and be there for others. And if I'm going to be there for others, I have to have some energy other than losing it all to work.
Yeah, it's hard. I think that it's really admirable to you know, go back to work and to you know, also to understand when to retire, when to figure out other things, put your energy towards people. Because it sounds like you got some really lovely people in your life, and you probably got to spend a lot more time with everyone.
I did. And I also then had more time and energy to do more service in my own community. I ran for the local school board and served on the school board for 4 or 5 years, and things like that I wouldn't have been able to do on top of working.
Yeah, there's always more opportunities. Like, giving up one thing does not, you know, does not mean there's no other things. There's so much out there.
Well put. Well put.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. And, you know, I think that you've done so much with the you know, pursuing Paralympics. And, you know, I understand that you're not a Paralympian, like, by title. But I think, you're already doing so much of the work. And you're already, you know, like, balancing a lot of, like, your life with it. It's awesome. It's awesome.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It takes a team.
It does. It does. But, you know, you still have a lot of, like, willpower, grit, like things that are that's hard. It's hard to push and push, but
it is. And things don't go smoothly all the time, do they?
No,
you got to power through. Got to be persistent, and think of all the problem solving we have to do to keep going and keep going forward, keep that trajectory going. Constant adjustment.
It's a lot, yeah. And you've already had to deal with a lot of like adjustments in life. Which is hard. I know that you wrote a book about some of your like early life experiences, which is Parakeet Races and Other Stories. Would you like to share a little bit about that? Because I think that's awesome, especially like when did you write it? And you know, I know it's about you and your family and your siblings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote it. I think I started in 2006, a year or so after I was in a chair. And like you pointed out, when you stop doing one thing, you have more time to do something else. And in my case, I had more time to reflect on a lot of things about my childhood. And in a sense, where did my resilience come from?
Yeah.
And where did my persistence come from? And in a sense, also, I was congratulating myself on my competence in facing this this challenge of transverse myelitis. And I realized that a lot of it came from my childhood. And then I realized, wow, there's so much about my childhood I don't remember. And specifically, I couldn't remember very much about my mother. As I mentioned, my mother died when I was 10, and I was the oldest of three girls, and I had three older brothers. And as some people would put it, we pretty much raised ourselves, although I give my dad a heck of a lot of credit. But he was very busy with his work, and we had a lot of time at home.
Yeah,
alone.
You're gonna have to feed all the kids, you know.
Right. And a lot of those days I remember, but I didn't have very many memories of when my mother was alive. So what I did, I wasn't planning to write a book, but I wanted to remember more about my mother and who she was, and it seemed like it was important that her memory not be gone. So I made appointments in person and on the phone to talk to each of my siblings. And the basic question was, what do you remember about our mom? We called our mother Moo it's a whole nother story, but what do you remember about Moo? And it was fascinating to hear from three brothers, two sisters, how few memories each of them had of her actually. So the book was trying to piece together any and all memories we had of her, which were not very many really. And then around that came all these family stories of when we were kids. And each little vignette in the book, Parakeet Races, recounts a story from when we were kids and sort of the escapades that we had. And then the book also adds a couple of chapters. One is an onset story that I wrote for... what's the wheelchair magazine? I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it right now. But I wrote an onset story for TM. And And I wrote a couple magazine articles, and a couple of those are in the book too. So I started to put together some chapters of my journey through TM and on into a life in a chair. And I started to tell some of these stories to my neighbor. Her name was Rachel. And she said, you should write down some of these stories. I don't know. She says, yes, you should. I said, well, it's hard to get started. She said, I'll tell you what, you write something down, and my mom, who's a English professor, we'll send it to her, and she can polish it up for you. She can help you. So I started writing down the stories that I'd been telling orally and written up a draft, and then my wife, Shelley, she'd read them and help me out with them a bit, and then I'd send it to Dr. Warby, Rachel's mom, and she would consult with me to help make it a little more professional in terms of the writing. And before you know it, I had enough stories that I thought, well, it's easy to self-publish these days. Nobody has to tell you this is good enough to publish or not. You can just publish it. So went to a self-publishing house and got it printed up. And I'm really happy to have it. And lots of relatives, in addition to my siblings, have really enjoyed having the book. And the title of it, Parakeet Races, it comes from one of the vignettes, because as kids, my brothers and sisters and I each had a parakeet. And when my dad wasn't around, we let the parakeets out of the cage and we would race them around the house in a frantic circle. If you let parakeets out in a closed room, they'll just fly in a circle. And we'd have races like a horse race with the parakeets.
That's awesome. But,
it's so wonderful to write your memoir. My wife, Shelley's written a very extensive memoir, and she worked on it for 4 years and went back into the history of her family and her town and her state and her community. And it's a wonderful thing to put together and then pull pictures together from your life, and your relatives and ancestors will have it forever. It's a great project to do.
It's awesome. I mean, like, I write nonfiction myself. I write a memoir, and I'm still on my journey. I think right now I'm at, 213 pages of.
Wow.
And I've been pretty happy with it.
Good for you.
I think that vignettes, first off, are really, really fun to write. I like doing like a vignette type style, because I can kind of like drift down into an important part of my life without having to stay forever. I can get mm-hmm. to, you know, the meat of it, like the really, you know, the important moment and how that like changed me as a person, without having to stay there too long. And I really, you know, I think integrating the TM side of your story into your work is super smart. Like it's great to do that, because it allows us to really like see who you are now, and like, you know, it adds a lot of like value of perspective to your story. Since you are having to navigate like a different life now, time is weird, and it's super nice to be able to reflect on really good childhood memories like that and kind of hold them in your heart. And I think that your book sounds like it kind of really captures that moment. I also think it's a really like lovely tribute to your mom. I know you said, you know, that you don't have the most memories, but at the same time, when you're able to kind of like capture all these little moments, all these little memories that you and all your siblings have had, you're able to create a very great like an outline of her, even if you don't know her completely. You're making like a just most glamorous portrait. That's like honestly really in of itself. Like you're making me cry. I think that's like a really beautiful thing to do. Even if part of it is like the wound of not knowing her all the way. It sounds like you made her a beautiful tribute. Beautiful tribute.
Well, thank you.
Thank you to our Ask the Expert sponsors, Amgen, Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease, Genentech, and UCB. Amgen is focused on the discovery, development, and commercialization of medicines that address critical needs for people impacted by rare, autoimmune, and severe inflammatory diseases. They apply scientific expertise and courage to bring clinically meaningful therapies to patients. Amgen believes science and compassion must work together to transform lives. Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease is a global biopharmaceutical company focused on serving patients with severe and rare disorders through the innovation, development, and commercialization of life-transforming therapeutic products. Their goal is to deliver medical breakthroughs where none currently exist, and they are committed to ensuring that patient perspective and community engagement are always at the forefront of their work. Founded more than 40 years ago, Genentech is a leading biotechnology company that discovers, develops, manufactures, and commercializes medicines to treat patients with serious and life-threatening medical conditions. The company, a member of the Roche Group, has headquarters in South San Francisco, California. For additional information about the company, please visit www.gene.com. UCB innovates and delivers solutions that make real improvements for people living with severe diseases. They partner with and listen to patients, caregivers, and stakeholders across the healthcare system to identify promising innovations that create valuable health solutions.